Hey everyone, it's your host James Olson here to talk about one of our latest projects. To expand our efforts to promote the fantastic bands and artists that make up the Vancouver music scene, Pacific Sound Radio has partnered with producer Felix Fung at Little Red Sounds, along with videographers Ray Machen and Marie Catafesta, to bring you an exciting live music session series called Once More with Feeling. Think KEXP or NPR's Tiny Desk series with a distinctly Vancouver focus. All of our episodes are available now only on YouTube, with new episodes dropping bi-weekly. That's Once More with Feeling, only on YouTube. We now return to your regularly scheduled podcast. Hello and welcome to Pacific Sound Radio, your go-to source for everything happening in the Vancouver music scene. I'm James Olson, and today we're speaking with vocalist and guitarist Tom Shand and vocalist and pianist Jacob Rigger of the alternative R&B duo Mid-May. After working together in various capacities for over a decade, Shand and Rigger have joined forces on a new project that captures the sounds of classic soul and R&B while drawing from contemporary sensibilities and influences. Their debut EP, Sound and Stays, was released in spring 2025 and is a thoroughly earnest and intimate listen, showcasing the undeniable musical chemistry between Shand and Rigger. Let's have a quick listen to a track off of the band's EP. This is Anhedonia. So why do I hear your voice so clear as if you're near? Although you've been gone for years. Tell me why do some things disappear that are sincere? Oh, well, others persevere through my eyes. Mid-May, great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, James. We really appreciate it.
Before we get started, just for our listeners' reference, who are we speaking to today?
My name is Jacob Regeer, and this is Tom Shand, and we are Mid-May.
Wonderful. I'm always looking for new music, and I'm always curious as to what other people are listening to. What have you two been listening to lately?
A lot of things. I really like the new Jordy Greep album a lot. It's crazy. It's kind of very unique. There's a band called Magdalena Bay. They do really good pop. I like them a lot. I didn't like the new Playboi Carti album. He used AI, which is not something I think is good for mainstream music.
I've been really digging the new Lady Gaga record, which feels like kind of a throwback record for her, so that's been really fun for me. And then I've been just listening to a lot of old standards lately, so not much new for me on that front there.
I was going to say, Tom, that Jordy Greep album was one of my favorites from last year. I like the first Magdalena Bay album more than the second one, but I think the second one's definitely a grower. And I haven't delved too far into the Playboi Carti controversy, but out of curiosity, like what capacity did he utilize AI?
Oh, straight up for like main vocal verses. Oh, just AI. Hell? Yeah. Super lazy.
Yeah, that's gross. I don't like that at all. Yeah, I would say that's definitely worthy of criticism for sure.
Mm-hmm. And just sounds bad too. It'd be like one thing, it was like not perfectly moral, but the result was good, but it's just like bad all the way through.
Yeah, because I know, you know, there's been a couple cases where bands have been criticized for using AI art for like singles or album covers or what have you. And I know there was some controversy with the final Beatles song that came out last year where they used AI, but they explained it was for mixing purposes, so you know there's some debate that could be had about that, but yeah, mm-hmm. Just flat out not even using your own voice in your own recordings is a thing that sounds like a bridge too far to me.
I think context is important for sure, like in those two cases like you mentioned, and then also the final product. I think for me is like, if at the end of the day it becomes like an insightful and like honest art piece, then how you used it, I think, can be fine. But I don't think anybody's really going to get close to that for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I think about it, there's this band I got turned on to a couple of years ago called Everything Everything. They're a really interesting like alternative pop group, and I know with one of their albums, they deliberately used AI to generate some lyrics, with the idea being that like it's within the context of a very sci-fi concept within the narrative of the songs themselves. So yeah, I think that's a fair point, Jacob, that context is everything when it comes to things like that.
For sure. And that's a great example of using it as like a benefit and to use it as something that like adds intrigue to the conversation that you're already having around your art. So that's great.
Totally. Well, enough about AI for now. But I understand that the two of you have been working together for over a decade. How did MidMay come together and what distinguishes this band from past projects you've been involved in?
Oh man, yeah. So I guess Tom and I started working on projects together in about 2011, 2012. And we've worked on a number of projects through then. And this one kind of came together out of the last project that we were working on was just going nowhere fast after COVID. And so through this together and just having the idea where we're going to keep it really tight and be able to keep a lot of control and kind of just work and rely on each other. And that's made things go really smoothly so far. So we've been really happy with that.
Anything to add, Tom?
It's a project where, you know, things have always fallen apart and this is kind of continued. So it's continuing.
Consistency is nice. I imagine in a case like that, since you've been friends for so long, it helps in that regard.
For sure. Our rapport is really good. We know each other's goods and bads. So that's good and bad for both of us, you know. But in the end, that just allows us to get into the nitty gritty of stuff and really get to work. And I think that's what we're both about. And I think that's how we allowed our relationship to like continue to flourish in that way.
Obviously, R&B is a large component of your sound, and I consider myself to be an R&B fan as well, especially contemporary alternative R&B, stuff like, you know, Frank Ocean and SZA and Miguel and artists like that. What is it about this style that really inspires you?
Well, I think for me, at least, I really like songs with good vocals, like, and R&B has always been a vocal genre. I also think I like the changes a lot. They've got a lot of, like, jazz kind of chords, but they're not jazz in that negative way that people associate with jazz. So you can do a lot of cool modulative and extended chords, and people think it's just poppy. You can get away with it, which is nice.
Yeah, that's a big part of it for me too. This the changes and the vocal, the having the vocals kind of be this a lot of the center of kind of the works. We both come from the school of like loving Stevie Wonder and that kind of era of R&B, and then coming through the 90s and through to today, I think we love all of those along that have, you know, happened in that genre.
Yeah, and when I think about it, R&B has been one of those genres that's been remarkably consistent, even including, you know, the artists that tend to rise to the top and get the most popular, even if it's a fleeting period in the spotlight, it can be really impactful just in terms of what they are able to bring to the broader music culture.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure. Like the way that it's become so diverse and how every kind of region in North America has played a different part and even at like different periods of time, a different role, like, you know, Motown to like LA in the 90s, like that kind of change. And yeah, it's just amazing to watch. And we're both huge fans of just like the growth and history of music as an art form. And so all of those kind of stories and little changes are fun for us to kind of play around with.
Totally. And alternative R&B itself is a evolving genre with many different interpretations. How would you define MidMay's sound within that context?
I think, you know, MidMay is like very like R&B light, I feel like. Like we're almost in like just the indie pop spectrum. So it's like R&B influenced a lot. I think that with us, the thing that makes it like unique is the fact that we are doing kind of like more standard Beatles-y harmonies while still trying to retain like R&B like rhythms in terms of like our drums or like our chord progressions.
Gotcha. And who would you say are some of the bands and artists that you have bonded over?
Stevie Wonder is like the big one. Obviously, the Beatles. I mean, a classic.
But I mean, these are where our passion for music started, is in these kind of like big format groups. And so these are kind of the places where we look first. Hall & Oates, Simon & Garfunkel. Mm-hmm. These kind of areas are our favorite to kind of play in. Big Steely Dan fans, obviously. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that.
Japanese city pop is very good. Like, that's really good 80s R&B from Japan.
I guess it's fitting that you just rattled off three famous duos back to back.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't recall when I got into city pop, but yeah, that was definitely a revelation, because I know, you know, 80s, North American 80s pop's pretty cool, but there's something really special about city pop. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just the different elements of Japanese culture that inform their approach to it, but some of that stuff, just some of the complexity, if you listen to like Anri's, you know, one artist. I think, funny enough, that's the second episode in a row in which I've name dropped Anri. City pop has wiggled its way into the conversation. Mm-hmm. So
Tetsuro Yamashita is really good. Yeah. Southern All Stars is a classic 80s Japanese band. They're very Hall & Oates-y. Like their classic album Kamakura is like, it just sounds like Japanese people doing Hall & Oates, which I can't complain about.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I should check that out, because the only, like, I usually default to Anri, and I'm not sure if he technically counts. He's kind of in his own space in terms of, speaking of artists that I've name dropped two episodes in a row, Takanaka. Think he might be city pop, but he might be more kind of the jazz fusion end of things. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, he's like of that era, and he's really good.
Oh yeah, sick. Yeah,
great orchestration and great playing. Great work. Yeah, great musicians.
And that surfboard guitar is just incredible.
Yeah, well, that's one thing that's like funny about all that music. It's like, it's all like Beach Paradise Baby is like the lyric subject matter of like 80% of city pop songs.
Mm-hmm. So every band is different when it comes to who handles the songwriting, and some bands are super collaborative while others are led by a single visionary. As a songwriting duo, what creatively have been some of the benefits of this arrangement?
So we've written together, and I've written a few songs. Tom's lately had a big chunk of that, and I'm trying to step up recently and take on a little bit more of my fair share of the writing responsibilities, but collaboration is, I think, where we both are at our best. Like, if we can bring a skeleton of a song to each other and then, you know, dress it up together, I think that's where we find the most success.
Any thoughts on that, Tom?
Pretty much the same. Yeah, we do well collaborating. It's been a lot of fun. I like collaborating with people musically, like with Midmay, like I write some of the songs on my own, but I find that with collaborating, you can really, like, things can go in directions that are like, you're never going to like take them in normally. And like, one thing that's always funny is like, I think I have good taste, and I think that writing is generally about taste. It's about making a sound and then deciding whether you sounded good or not, you know? But it is funny sometimes where when your taste is wrong, and it's nice to be wrong, and someone's like, no, this is actually better, and it makes the song better.
Yeah, I would say in a situation like that, it is beneficial to be open-minded. Do you find it's been a process, potentially, of, you know, being able to let certain things go when it comes to an element of a song that you wrote that you really like, but in the long run, it just doesn't fit in the, you know, as a puzzle piece in the broader context of the finished work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And then you just have another puzzle piece over somewhere else, you know, hopefully you'll make a puzzle that it'll fit in later, you know? I think, like, we've both had moments where we've had to take things back or put things in that maybe we weren't at first in agreement with, and like, you got to check yourself. I think on the flip side of that, the way that we approach writing, I think we bring stuff together at a level where it's like, you know, you're allowing the other person to kind of do their thing on it without impeding them, and just kind of agreeing that together we're going to build something that's better than the one of us would make on our own.
In the time that you've worked together, how would you say you two have grown as players and collaborators?
For myself personally, like 100 times. I think Tom and I have been playing together for so long. He's seen me go through 10 different versions of myself as a player. And I think coming into where I'm at now, I think I'm in a much better place in terms of being able to provide what I want to for, you know, for music, for the songs that we're trying to put together. Trying to stick true to the thesis statements of songs more so than trying to provide parts and X, Y, or Z. What about you, man? Over the last 10, 12 years, any changes?
I think that for me, I think my big change has just been like getting my musicality like tighter, especially singing has been something in the last few years I've really been working on getting better, because Jake's got all this singing background and he's got like a powerful voice. So I've got to step up to try to even begin to compete with that, you know? So it's been good to have that challenge where, you know, if people heard me sing, they'd be like, he's good. But then if they hear me sing contrasted with him, it's a little bit different, right? So, it's been great in that regard. And just songwriting in general, I think you just always get better at it. And for me, songwriting is, I'm not precious about my songs. So if they get to a certain point and I don't think they're good, I'll just scrap them and maybe I'll salvage a little part of it. But you just learn what works. It's just through experience and time.
You gotta make enough bad stuff first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like a comedy, sketch comedy, right? Like, you can't have a good sketch without having like 6 bad sketches.
Yeah,
there's a, because I enjoy just watching documentaries and reading books about musicians just in general. And with some of the books that I've read written by songwriters, that is an interesting through line that a lot of them have to say, that like, they have just hundreds of songs that they've written and most of them are crap. And it's the ones that, you know, actually rise to the top are the ones that that people wind up hearing.
That's why like some artists are being smart. They're putting clauses when they die that you can't release any of their music. Cause that, to me, that must be so embarrassing that you write like a song that like you think is garbage and then you die. And then like they're releasing it as like your hidden, lost, yeah, precious tracks. And you're like, Oh no.
That was my cutting room
floor. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember a couple years ago they put out a Kurt Cobain quote-unquote solo album, which was really just like demos and stuff that he never intended to have people hear. So, yeah, I'm in alignment with that, where it's, you know, it gets to be a tricky thing where it's how much of the archive material is just stuff that they didn't get around to releasing, and how much of it was never intended to be listened to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when your consumption medium is like the same as like, there's no separation, right? There's no Smithsonian for like recording sound system stuff, right? So if you're just going to stick it up on Spotify with everything else, it's going to get viewed through the same lens. And then there's an entirely other problem there. Was just how you're addressing and assessing the piece of art that you're looking at. Like, I'm okay with, you know, in the future, if somebody wants to look at something that I did, that's fine, but don't think of it as this other thing that I presented and did in a much different way.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's like one thing, like, if a super fan orders, like, a bootleg DVD, then, like, some random person be like, I want to check out Jacob Bergier's music, and it's, like, the piano demo 5, and you're like, this guy is he's very undercooked.
Yeah,
what an undercooked artist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a broader more complicated issue, I guess. It really depends on who owns like the rights and the estates for deceased artists, but yeah, another broad topic. Yeah. Much like AI.
And what should the standard be if on that kind of IP if there's no statement left in the will or whatever? Like, that's a very complicated social issue, right?
Yeah, but now that I think about it, just delving into, and this is a very brief tangent, I promise, but I know delving into the history of literature, Franz Kafka, I think he either stipulated in his will or he said directly to one of his friends before he died, destroy all my writings, and his friend thankfully ignored him and published everything that Franz was working on. But that is true.
That happens sometimes. I think that was the same with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He threw that out and like his wife like took it out of the garbage, and it was a classic.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even know that. It's crazy. Yeah. But I mean, honestly, that whole topic could just be a podcast episode in and of itself.
Exactly. A lot of Brahms's music was found like scattered on his floor after he died in closets, stuffed in boxes, like just like snippets of stuff, you know, and that's some of his most famous melodies, stuff that he didn't really put out.
Yeah. You never know. I'm going to ask this question within the context of at this time of recording, the band very recently held an EP release show, which I hope went very well. And the question that I have that is in relation to that is, how has being based in Vancouver and part of the local music scene shaped your music?
Oh, man. That goes back a long ways. I mean, shouts out to Space Elevator and to Five Alarm Funk. We've both worked with Mike Allen from there for a number of years and came up together and kind of starting to play shows in the city and stuff. And so that came from like, you know, jazz and ska horn kind of started it all off for us. And then, yeah, moving forward, starting to work on like different projects and bumping into different people around the city, playing with, my buddy Houston from, Highland Highway. He's like, you know, another guy that really helped me kind of just figure things out along the way. So yeah, I think the people around have played a big part. I had a great opportunities growing up for musical education as well. So I just was able to kind of chug along a pretty open path for that for myself. Mm-hmm. What about you, man?
Yeah. I mean, I think Vancouver is like, it's interesting because there's a lot of good to it and a lot of bad, especially I feel like post-COVID, we've lost so many music venues. So I wish there was more opportunity to do music in Vancouver. I find like it's just, yeah, it's more segregated, and I don't know, people are like, we're in an interesting time with music, I think, where like people aren't really like interfacing with it the same way they used to, and maybe that'll change. Like nowadays I feel like if someone's really enjoying your performance, a lot of times they'll just be looking at their phone because they're like, oh, I love this, I'm going to share it with someone, right? And that's not necessarily something that feels too good as like a player in terms of audience feedback. But yeah, I think Vancouver has like a lot of potential. I think it was better like 10 years ago, but maybe everything was, so.
Yeah, man, I think if you asked someone that was, because I think we're around the same age, but I think if you asked someone who's 10 years older than us, they'd say it was, the scene was even better 20 years ago, so mm-hmm. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, they would for sure.
Yeah.
Shouts out to Seelan Hall and the punk scene that came up in the 90s, early O's down there.
I played in Seelan Hall in like 2009. I played there once
near the very end of it all. Yeah.
I saw a lot of ska bands there.
That's an interesting byline now that I think about ska all the way to alternative R&B. I guess they're kind of in the same neighborhood, but then again, like I'm thinking about my own experience as a player and the fact that I've played, I think every band that I've played in has played some different style of rock music, so.
That's a pretty diverse genre, so I'm sure you had a lot of different areas you touched there.
Yeah, for sure. And on a similar note to your EP release show, of course, that also ties into the release of your debut EP, Sound and Stays, which dropped on March 14th of 2025 this year at this time of recording. I understand that you had to, quote unquote, fight against the wind to get to the point of making an EP. What can you tell us about creating this release and some of the challenges you had to overcome?
Oh, yeah. An amazing set of challenges. We had some of the most extensive hardware issues I think we've ever had. We ended up having to do a bunch of stuff multiple times and on equipment that we normally wouldn't use for specific things. Like I used just a tiny synth to do a lot of the piano parts. So that was a lot different.
We first recorded the piano like acoustically. We mic'd my piano, but you know, you have a piano in a non-studio room, it just doesn't sound good. Or like with my microphones, I couldn't get it to sound good. So we instead used a digital piano because I mean they sound good, and I think like 95% of pianos you hear now are digital pianos, probably even more than that.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Same with drums. Though are the drums we did for real.
And I guess to confirm, you recorded Sound and Stays on your own. Did you work with any producers or engineers or anyone else, or was this an entirely homegrown operation?
Just homegrown. Did it in my bed. Aside from the drums, which were recorded in our drummer's little studio space he has, everything was done in my bedroom. And it was just I used Logic, and I just edited it and mixed it and mastered it.
Gotcha. And I guess handling everything in-house, did that contribute at all to any of the delays in terms of, you know, being able to go over every element of every song in meticulous detail? I might be projecting a little bit, but I'm curious.
I think the struggle is that the kind of music that we're doing is generally done in studio spaces, and we didn't do, like, our EP doesn't have like a bedroom aesthetic. It's not like lo-fi. And so it was hard to like sell something that sounded like it could be done potentially in a studio as opposed to fully embracing the lo-fi. And
so I think more so we spent time rather than being meticulous, trying to shoot to a level above what we were working with.
Gotcha. I mean, when I was listening to the release, and I mean no disrespect to how the drums were recorded, but it's funny you mentioned kind of the lo-fi quality, but in that the way that the drums kind of sounded to me, it almost sounded like a drum machine. Obviously, I'm happy to hear that it was organic, but what I think lent to me as a listener is that the release sounds like it was recorded as a duo. And I'm curious as to, you know, why was it important for you to capture the essence of Min May as a two-piece on this release?
I mean, I think a lot of these songs, like, we worked them up as a two-piece and kind of got to a point with them where we said we didn't want to send them out the door like that. We wanted to kind of send them out in a more stylized way with drum and bass, with a full rhythm section, really kind of give them their chance to shine. And I don't think it requires, like, I think it wasn't about showing off ourselves more as it was letting the songs do the talking, and that's kind of just what they dictated for us.
Yeah, one of the tracks, Reaching Out, we actually did it as a duo song. There was no drums or bass. And then I kind of like finished it, like I mixed it, and I show it to people, and everyone's like, it kind of feels empty. It kind of feels, and we're like, you know what? Let's just add drum and bass to this track as well. Make it a little bit more full.
Are there any central themes or stories that run through Sound and Stays? And do you approach lyrics from a personal perspective, or do you tend to like to write more conceptually?
I mean, I think they're all love songs, aren't they? In some way or another. I think that's a common theme in a lot of what we're writing about. It's just like one of the most important aspects of human life and happiness is just kind of feeling accepted in community and in your relationships around you. And kind of the feeling of fighting against a headwind to kind of not only be successful within that, but to just like allow yourself to accept the happiness within that too. Hence the title of the EP, Sounds and Stays.
I guess, Jacob, are you the central lyricist for your music?
On this one, I think I wrote a little bit more of the lyrics.
No, you didn't.
Oh, on this one, no.
This one, you wrote one of the lyrics. One of them. I wrote three of the lyrics.
Right. So, yeah. No, not on this one.
Interesting. Yeah, I was curious about that as to what the split would be. Tom, would you say that Jacob's on the money with that?
Oh, overall? I mean, it depends on what month you're asking us in. You come back in 6 months and we could have a different story for you. That's one Fair good enough. Thing about how we're working together is just the pushing and pulling and allowing each other to kind of strive and do each other's best for each other. Yeah.
Yeah. And I generally find like with our lyrics, yeah, we kind of, again, because we like the same music, we're going to generally have the same kind of lyricism. I think when I write songs, I like emotion more than meaning. Like meaning is nice, but like you don't really need to have meaning in lyrics. If you can feel them, then it's good in my mind. So a lot of times when I write songs, I'll get like a melody I like, and I'll start singing gibberish. And usually whatever that gibberish is will kind of formulate whatever the song's going to be. And that gibberish usually comes from a natural emotive place from whatever the music you're making.
Yeah, let the song do the talking.
Yeah, there you go. As I mentioned, I've worked with a number of different approaches when it comes to lyrics, and yeah, there's almost like two camps when it comes to that. It's the, no, let the music guide it, or, you know, that really strong intentionality in terms of like, no, I have to be communicating a very clear message with my words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've written songs in both ways. Like, I've written songs where I wrote everything first, wrote all the lyrics first, and patchworked it all in based on, like, you know, syllabic breakdown and within the melodies. And I've also written songs where, you know, similar style to what Tom's talking about, where you just allow the shape of the song to kind of give you some words and then kind of let the ball roll from there. And it's definitely more free-flowing and natural one way than the other. Setting text is a difficult thing to do in general. And if you can do it, then it's an amazing thing to have in your pocket. But I don't think it's something that everybody can rely on the day-to-day. And it's also just, it's an extremely large amount of work in comparison of direct interaction with every single note and every single moment, rather than letting a song breathe and be itself.
Yeah, there's something to be said about avoiding the fight between how the melody's supposed to sound and then like trying to cram the words into it that you want to include.
Yeah, it's always funny when like people like, well, they'll set up a phrase with certain amount of notes, but then their words are too many, so they have to like forsake the phrase now and try to squeeze in a bunch of notes in that one little pocket. So a lot of
context doesn't match the melody. Yet.
Yeah, I never write songs that way. I don't think I can really do it that way. I find that if I were to perceive lyrics as written things, it's not how I like to think about those things. You know, if I were to like songs I like, even if I were to just like read the lyrics of that song, I'd be like, "What is this?" You know, like it's just not a. It's not how I think of music at all.
Yeah, it's feedback that I've got from my producer a couple times. It's just like, your lyrics are too wordy. we gotta rewrite that for it to fit the melody. So like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I suppose I'm more from that other camp, but who knows? Maybe I'll let go and just go with the melody with a future song.
Mm-hmm. I don't
know. Yeah, give it a shot.
Yeah, the gibberish method. It's tried and true. I love it.
Yeah. Be more, I don't know, surrealist or expressionistic with with lyrics rather than,
or
I don't know.
You know, once you get a small phrase, then everything, it'll just kind of catch, and then everything will just kind of click from there, and then you'll get kind of a good bulk of it done, and then patchwork it from there.
Totally.
That'd be my suggestion. I need to do it myself. I need to get a couple of those cracked out soon here.
There you go. What song off of this release means the most to you?
To me, I love Reaching Out very much. I think that's just like a great moment and a great little song. I think it just tells such a wonderful little short story and is such a clear and concise way of saying that. And then Riverside for me too is just more of like a, brings back more of a personal anecdote, more direct personal anecdote, and is less of an open story. But yeah, I'd have to go with those two for me.
Yeah, and for me, probably the song Dreams. I just think it's like a kind of like an emotion and like song that like I generally like, you know, it's like you wanna be iterative, but in the end, you kind of just start. Eventually, you just make a few of the same pieces of art again and again and again. And I feel like Dreams is one of those songs where, like, I'll probably write a few other Dreams again at some point. And I've written Dreams probably before I wrote Dreams as well.
Right. I think I wrote Dreams.
When you get to that moment where you're influencing yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And I always, like, I'm not going to give the game away, but I definitely have, like, things I like to do, you know, and if you knew them, you'd hear them in a lot of the music where he's doing that thing he likes to do.
He's doing that thing.
Yeah.
I'm like that when I play bass. There's very specific like note sequences I like to do. And if anyone picked up on it, I'd be like, oh, hack frog confirmed.
Yeah. Me and bass is like that. Like, I can give that one away. I love sliding up to the nine. Oh, yeah. Slide up to the nine all day long.
Oh yeah. I love the piano slide from the five down to the three. That's my favorite. Mm-hmm. Right at the end of the song.
Yes, right. Little tag.
Trying to think of how I describe my tell. Probably have to more show it, but like, yeah. Nah, I'll keep that to myself. My bass playing.
Can't give the game away.
Can't give the game away.
We say we're musicians, but we're really just a little bag of tricks.
Yeah, exactly.
That bag is fun, we have nothing.
I have like six toys that I can play with, and if I've showed them all to you, you're going to find me pretty dull. Yeah.
Watch me guitar solo for 2 minutes, and then don't watch anymore.
Hey, I mean, Angus Young's built an entire career off of using one single scale to write guitar solos.
And
so
one dance.
Yeah, and one dance, so you can... If you got a shtick, you can market it. You can ride off that for a long time.
Yeah, well, if it ain't broke, right?
Yeah. What do you hope listeners take away from Sound and Stays? Is there a particular mood or feeling that you want to evoke?
I think with the EP, it's easy listening. You know, I think I want people to put it on and just kind of enjoy it. You know, you know, if they're doing something fun, it might be kind of fun to put some of those songs on, like Riverside, you know. But yeah, I don't think we set out to make like a challenging music, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a hard headphone listen, you know. But yeah, just, you know, some nice music that's catchy that maybe when people stop listening to it, they'll still have it in their head for a little bit.
Definitely, it's easygoing, I think. The thing I want people to take away is just like, you know, welcome. This is kind of like an introduction for a lot of people for us. And I hope that like they were liking the first step. You know, there's lots more to come and it's going to be a fun ride. So I think that's where that's what I would say to people.
Speaking of which, I imagine you two are already working on new material. What creative directions are you looking to take with your next collection of songs?
I think we're looking at a lot more of those, a lot more rhythmic changes, a lot more kind of funk and R&B stylings that we weren't able to kind of get on this project. Because when we started writing it, we were writing it with just two instruments in mind. Now coming into this next set of tunes, we've had a much freer ability to kind of orchestrate stuff, which gives us, you know, a lot more variation, a lot more toys to play with at one time. So yeah, I'm looking forward to showing people a little more funk, a little more up-tempo stuff. Yeah.
It's always fun to write around bass and drums, and Mid-May as a project, we don't really write around bass and drums. So yeah, I think it'd be, as Jake was saying, cool to make more tracks where like those things are like built in to the structure of it, where I think like I like a lot of our songs, obviously, but they're done with the idea that, yeah, they're just piano guitar. So they're moving around harmonically a lot. But rhythmically, they're not really doing much. So if we could get, yeah.
Yeah, that's the next step for us, I think.
Yeah, and of course, the band also performs with a full band, not just as a duo. Would there be some thought given to potentially bringing in another member onto the recordings?
Oh yeah, I mean we've got our bass player and our drummer who were both on this EP with us, and no changes in the immediate horizon on personnel there. They've been great to work with, and it's a great arrangement for us. Allows us to keep the creativity that we're looking for and kind of move forward in a solid way. And yeah, it's going to be the same formula moving forward for a little while here, I think.
And working with the bassist is good. We have a track actually that's it's still cooking, like deeply, deeply cooking.
Yeah,
still in the prep phase. But we got all the chord progressions and we got all like the structure figured out. And we were able to just bring him in, and he was able to kind of write his own bass line, and he did exactly what we wanted. So it was cool to collaborate with him as well.
Yeah, that was like, still in the crock pot.
I play bass, but I will admit he's a little bit better at bass than me, so it's nice great. To have that.
Yeah.
And kind of gave this away, of course, but Mid May have performed as a duo and with a full band. What sort of vibe are you seeking to create with these different live setups?
I think at first we were looking just to like fit into as many spaces as possible. And I think it's always good to be able to pair songs up and down. For our generation, we grew up having acoustic versions of stuff and like MTV Live and like
Tiny
all
Desk.
This kind of Tiny Desk. And so I think that's something that I never really want to get away from. I don't think we are ever really going to get away from is wanting to have our cake and eat it too in that sense. I'm always going to want to sit down by myself and play these tunes piano in one voice, and I'm also going to want to play them with Tom as a duo and with 30 piece band one day, maybe, depending on what we've got and where we're going with it.
I suppose that also gives you some flexibility as well, if day of, like, God forbid your drummer gets into a Spinal Tap style accident, you're like, oh well, I guess we just got to play without a drummer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You never got to get ready if you stay ready.
I haven't heard that before, but that's good.
That's RuPaul, I think.
That's RuPaul. Nice. And this is something I noticed going over your YouTube channel. The band has covered songs from a variety of artists outside of R&B, including Daft Punk, Porter Robinson, and Radiohead. Can you describe the thought process behind selecting a song and putting that mid-May twist on it? Because again, that's those are artists that you wouldn't think an R&B group would cover.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cover selections that we do are a large portion of just we want to show people what we like and, just kind of what we're into, showing us the different flavors that we enjoy. They're just fun and playful for us. So it's a very low stakes event for us. It's just fun. We enjoy doing them. And
sometimes we just check the Spotify Global Top 50. And if there's a song on there that sounds halfway decent, we'll do that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then for the mid-May twist, it's pretty straight up. It's like, if there's an opportunity to add a harmony, you add a harmony, and that's more or less it.
Pretty straightforward.
Without giving anything away, have there been any artists that you've been thinking like, oh yeah, we got to cover one of their songs one day?
Oh yeah, there's a bunch. Yeah. I mean, I haven't won this yet because, we all have our opinions and we all try to I'm happy with the results, but I always try to get cheesy 90s R&B. Like, I wanted to do All My Life by Casey and JoJo. Yeah. We might be doing a Brian McKnight song soon. Yep, that'll be a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. So, yeah, we're looking at bringing some different eras into it. and having a bit of fun with that. The thing about that era is just way more work for me personally. Well, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. He's the one who's going to have to sing at the end of the day.
To do one of those, yeah.
I mean, I'd recommend D'Angelo, but that might be a challenge vocally.
Yeah, do an Untitled by D'Angelo. With would be just great.
Two people, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
no pressure.
that would take a little while to get ready.
Well, now I think about it, because you name drop Steely Dan. There was an excellent documentary about quote-unquote yacht rock that came out a couple months ago. And of course, like as a result, I was on a Michael McDonald kick. If you haven't covered like Steely Dan or any of those folks, I mean, that might be worth exploring.
Yeah, the big Michael McDonald song, what's it called? I just can't keep forgetting, whatever.
Not in love anymore. I keep forgetting.
That's the one. Yeah, yeah. It's the one that song samples the famous hip hop song with Nate
Dogg. Snoop Dogg and Nate Dogg.
No, it's not Snoop Dogg. It's Warren G and Nate Dogg. The name slips my mind right now.
But yeah, that's a great. That whole Michael McDonald album that's off of. Is
so good.
One of my favorite.
Boss Gags is a great artist of that era.
Yeah.
He's a yacht rocker.
Boss Gags.
Trying to think. Oh, yeah. Another one just came to mind. This song specifically, I just absolutely love. Christopher Cross, Ride Like the Wind.
Oh, well, yeah. Classic, that whole album's awesome, too.
Yeah.
He won a Grammy for that, didn't he? It's like a
They talked about that in the documentary. He won, I'm not sure if he won Album of the Year, but he won like Best New Artist
that year.
I think in that same year, Michael McDonald and Kenny Loggins won like Best Songs. It was like the yacht rock year.
Nice, yeah. Kenny Loggins. People know him just for like Danger Zone, but he's got like a lot of great yacht rock bangers.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was kind of his pivot away from when yacht rock's like popularity kind of faded. He got into doing soundtrack stuff like Footloose and Danger Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And big shouts out to Ed Mota. His album AOR is one of my favorites. He's a Brazilian guy. And there's two versions of the album, one in English and one in Portuguese. Both are great. The English version is fun because he collabed on the English translations with a bunch of different lyricists to make them fit with the melodies. And the Portuguese one is also just, it's great to hear him sing in his own language. But he's a really great player. Ed Mota is one of my favorites.
Nice. So, of course, you got a deep well to draw from when it comes to future cover ideas, of course.
Oh, yeah.
What does the future hold for mid-May?
More of the same, that's what I think. I think we've got a nice kind of ball rolling. We want to get into more studio time, start collaborating with maybe some producers, stuff like that. We've got a couple of guys that we've been talking to and have in mind. We'll see how that goes moving forward. And other than that, we're continuing on what we're doing. More covers coming on the way on YouTube and more singles hopefully coming in the next little while. Down the pipeline, we'll be able to announce some hopefully, and yeah, we'll see what happens with that soon.
Who are some of the collaborators you have in mind?
Oh, I mean, we've been talking with a couple of different guys that I will keep to myself because
rats.
Yeah. But maybe I'll let you know off air, but a couple of people that I've been talking to for getting into studio time, and we've written a bunch of grants, and we'll see how those go, and we'll see if any of those kick back for us and speed up the process there. But yeah, it's going to be fun. In terms of other people that I'd like to collaborate around town, there's a dime a dozen, like I mentioned earlier, Mike and Space Elevator and the Uncle Strut guys are super awesome. Yeah. Highland Highway. And yeah, the list goes on. Cordy M. Sad. She just actually put out she was at our show last week. She just put out a single too. It's really great. So
she's really talented. Check that out.
Good stuff. Well, thanks again, guys. This has been a lot of fun. I just got one more question for the both of you. What local bands or artists would you recommend we check out or bring on the show for a future episode?
Oh, yeah. Well, to continue my list, so let's go recap. Cordy M. Sad, she's awesome. Anna Katarina. Haley Wallace, she's one of my favorite singers around right now. She's got an amazing voice. Go check
really
her
cool
out.
R&B, yeah.
Really cool R&B singer. Highland Highway for a nice psychedelic rock. Two drummers. So that's a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun. And look out for Space Elevator coming up for their album probably next year. That one's going to be amazing. Maybe at the end of 2025. And there was one more I was thinking of, but I'll have to tell you later.
What about you, Tom? Last opportunity.
I think he did a good list right there. Yeah,
stole all of our homies.
A lot of cool artists and musicians. One thing about Vancouver that's really cool is I'm actually generally surprised by the level of musicianship. Like, we've done gigs sometimes where, like, you know, they're not like the biggest gigs ever, and we're playing with bands, and I'm like, every band I feel like should be like doing really taking a lot.
Yeah, I think the big message from us is just like, get out there. You're gonna, if you catch 10 shows in a quarter of a year, you're gonna see probably 8 great shows,
mm-hmm,
with at least one amazing band on every bill. So you come out one night and you see 4 great bands, and that's a great night for anybody, right? So I think just getting out there more is the biggest one. Go check out your local venues, and you'll figure out pretty quick where to look from there, and find stuff on Spotify, and just go talk to people. Go talk to these artists. We're out here, you know. Come say hi.
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking my language, preaching to the choir. I've been running the show for a number of years now, and I haven't run out of amazing bands and artists to feature on this. So, again, thank you guys. The EP sounds really great. Excited to hear what you guys get up to next. And, yeah, this has been awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, James. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, James Olson. Before we close this episode off with one more song by our featured guest, I just wanted to let you know that you can keep up with what we're up to on Facebook and Instagram at Pacific Sound Radio, and on our website at pacificsoundradio.com. If you like the show, you can give us a 5-star rating and a positive review on your podcast platform of choice that lets you leave reviews. This is Reaching Out.
Around you there was a mask I wore.